We're going to collect these as after we pass them around. Among the many topics he treats are democracy and economic power, imperialism and U.S. interventionism, terrorism and globalization, political bias in the U.S. news media, which is the subject of today's talk, ideology and history, race, gender, and class, the overthrow of communism and fascism past and present. So please help me welcome Dr. Michael Parenti.
Thank you. I thought there was going to be amplification. I blew my voice out driving over. I had some. I had Puccini's Tosca on, and I sang along, and I just don't have it. I just realized. I've been waiting to be discovered for years, but it doesn't happen. Well, I thought I'd talk about something kind of academic, you know, not Bush lies to us and all that, right? But something sort of theoretical, even dealing in a way with some of the epistemology of this whole issue. At the same time, relating it to, for instance, how U.S. foreign policy is portrayed. As you know, most mainstream reporters and news editors believe that they're objective in their reporting. They consider themselves professionals. They'll tell you that. When I wrote my book, Inventing Reality, Politics of the News Media, 2 years before Manufacturing Consent ever came out, I was surprised. I then, in response to the book, I got on a lot of panels with journalists. And I was naive after writing this book and saying all these things. I found out it was true, you know. These guys would be indignant, and they would be furious. And they would say, you're telling me I'm not a free agent. I'll have you know in 20 years of working for Cox newspapers, I have always said what I like, or working for Fox or CBS. I said, you say what you like because they like what you say. But if you ever get beyond a certain parameter, then you'll feel the tug of the leash come in on you. Now, so they believe this. They believe that they stick to the facts, that they have no ideological axe to grind. Fox News even has adopted as its copyrighted slogan, fair and balanced, you know, which causes many of us to either smile or wince. But it's not just the reporters and the editors. Even many of the conservative pundits and columnists who overpopulate the corporate-owned media, they too seem to believe that their views represent the unadorned truth. Of course, they might admit that they sometimes voice a personal opinion, but such opinions are well anchored in facts, they insist. Now, the usual criticism made against this claim of objectivity is that objectivity doesn't exist. The minute one sits down to write a story or even a lead paragraph or put together a news analysis, one is making judgment calls, selecting, omitting, inserting certain things, linking them in certain ways. Furthermore, the very nature of human perception itself makes objectivity rather improbable. We're not just passive receptors sponging up images and information. If it was so, we would all agree with each other. Perception involves selecting and organizing data into comprehensive units. So you're actively engaged when something is being fed to you. You're an active participant in that. In a word, the very act of perceiving is also an act of editing. And this brings us to the much quoted classical statement by Walter Lippmann. Actually, nobody quotes Lippmann anymore. Nobody reads him anymore. But he used to be, oh, you do, okay. Who else? Okay. Oh, that's good. Do you read Public Opinion?
Yes.
That was written in 1921. Right, okay. So written in a book over 80 years ago, Lippmann says, we don't perceive reality and then define it. We first define it and then perceive it. Lippmann talked about the world being a blooming, buzzing confusion. that had to be organized into manageable perceptions. You know, there was a recent report about people who had their eyesight restored after an entire lifetime of blindness. They had these with new technologies. They had the mechanisms of sight reconstructed, and what they discovered is that these people could not see after a successful operation. That is, they could kind of make out shades and shapes, but they really couldn't see objects. And what the researchers conclude, correctly, I think, is that we see not just with our eyes, but with our brains. And their brains had not, at least those sections of the brain involved in sight, had not developed the capacity to organize perception, at least not for a while. We hope that maybe with practice, exposure, some other part of the brain will pick it up. I don't know. But that kind of almost bears out something that Lippmann was saying. I don't think he had any idea. He was talking about the physiology of perception, but it is. Another thing that works against the establishment's claim to objectivity is the realization that we all have our own way of looking at things. We all resemble each other in some ways, very much so, but each of us is also a unique creation. No two persons are exactly alike. So some portion of our perceptual experience is unique also. And that's often carried to hyper-individualist extremes. You know, the people say, well, your view, your opinion, that's your reality, you have created your truth and your existence and opinion. And usually, you know, usually accompanied with a claw-like gesture to the sternum, say, this is something that's in you and that's that. Which isn't very helpful if you want to deal with politics, you see. That's the only problem. And it shouldn't be overstated. The mental selectors, in fact, please don't get offended, but the mental selectors and filters we use to organize our perceptions are not mostly idiosyncratic. They're not usually of our own creation. Most of our personal perception is shaped by a variety of things outside of ourselves, such as the dominant ideology, ethical beliefs, social values and biases, one's position in the social structure, one's material interests, etc. Carl Becker, in his book called The Heavenly City of the 18th Century Philosophers, another good book that nobody reads anymore, about 65 years ago, I think he was the first to frame the phrase a climate of opinion. And he argued that ideas and notions about reality don't just spring forth in vacua, they circulate and they reinforce each other and gain acceptance through a process of multilateral exposure. More often than we realize, we accept an idea because it fits in the climate of opinion. The idea doesn't create a climate of opinion. The reason it's out there and people start writing books about it and all that is because it's already in the climate of opinion. Alvin Gulner, in his book, The Coming Crisis of Western Sociology, written only 35 years ago, I'm closing the gap, I'm moving up here, I'll get it to today somehow, he argues that our readiness to accept or reject something rests less on its argument and evidence and more how it fits the background assumptions that are embedded in it. The notions that don't fit our background assumptions or the ongoing background assumptions are seen as too far out, lacking in credibility. Now, today we dissidents and radicals rarely refer to Gulner or Becker or Lippmann or we don't talk about climate of opinion except in a more ephemeral way that it's a climate of opinion is, you know, shifting with opinion polls and all that. When Becker meant something more as a fundamental construct. But we have an equivalent concept, I think. It might be the dominant paradigm. Have you ever seen that? There are even some people who have bumper stickers which instruct the drivers behind them to subvert the dominant paradigm. And I want to get one of those. I haven't yet. A paradigm is a basic philosophical or theoretical framework within which empirical investigations are performed with the idea of supporting the paradigm's basic precepts. The paradigm's a prime model from which you can get hypotheses to test. Now, the implicit agreement within the corporate media about what should be the dominant paradigm and the dominant ideology, this is what I call the unanimity of bias. And the unanimity of bias is what passes for objectivity. Generally, when these guys are saying this is objectivity or we're being fair and balanced, they're talking about the fact that they have a dominant ideology or an ideological conformity. So objectivity and ideological conformity are really just about the same thing in the major media. Well, that raises certain troubling questions for us. If objectivity is little more than ideological conformity, then isn't one paradigm about as reliable or unreliable as another? With objectivity out of our reach, what happens to reality? If objectivity is unattainable, is all truth then just opinion and belief? And what becomes the basis for embracing a dissident analysis rather than an orthodox one? What makes one subjective bias opinion better than another? Are we doomed to an aimless relativism? Yes, we are, class dismissed. No, we aren't. No, we aren't. First, I'd argue that although radical views are not without inaccuracies and insufficient data at times, obviously, they generally are more reliable than the dominant view because they are more regularly challenged and tested against evidence. People approach the dissenting viewpoint, if they ever even get a chance to be exposed to it, they approach it after having been conditioned through most of their lives to the dominant ideology. It's not what they're used to hearing. It doesn't fit their background assumptions. Where did you hear that? They'd be quick to say. They self-censor. They even tune out. Even when they're sitting and exposed to something. I've seen that when if the conversation goes a certain way, a certain people, their eyes glaze over, and there's a protective internalized censor. Conversely, people are less likely to complain of the one-sidedness of their mainstream education and more likely to complain of the one-sidedness and dogmatic political correctness of any challenge to their indoctrination. So rather than seeking a diversity of views, they actively defend themselves from such exposure. I remember some years ago, almost 20 years ago, I taught a year at Cornell University. Nice little elitist school. I think it was a course on elections and media, something like that. And about two-thirds into the course, some students, a lot of resistance. These guys were heading on their careers. They didn't want to hear some of this stuff. And a couple of them complained before the class, as we were beginning, said, "We're getting only one viewpoint in this course." And I said, "Well, that isn't exactly true. We got this reading, that reading, that reading." I pointed out. I said, "But you're really, in effect, you're right, because I'm giving you only one viewpoint, and the preponderance of the readings is that viewpoint." "Yeah, yeah." I said, "Well, how many of you have had more than just one or two social science courses since you've been here?" All their hands went up. I said, "History, sociology, political science, economics, how many?" All their hands went up. I said, and how many of you got this viewpoint in those courses?" No hands went up. I mean, that was really discouraging. No hands went up. One student, he went, a little bit in one course, a little bit. And then I said, "And how many of you in those courses complained that you were getting only that viewpoint and not this one?" Again, no hands went up. I said, so your complaint is not that you're getting only one viewpoint, but that for the first time in your education here at Cornell, you're getting another one, and you don't want it. It makes you uncomfortable. It annoys you. You want to go back to the other viewpoint. You want to go back to... No? Well... Well, you know, all this makes dissent that much more difficult, but also that much more urgent, correct? Newspaper people are fully immersed, or news people, I mean media people, are fully immersed in an ideology whose main precept is that it is not an ideology. They have little awareness of how they misrepresent so much of the news. You know, for opinion manipulation to be effective, you have to not know you're being manipulated. What gets fascinating is that even the manipulators don't realize they're being manipulated or that they are manipulating. They have so internalized this whole dominant paradigm that it's just the truth. It's the facts. And it's the departures from it that are immediately suspect and open to attack. The most insidious forms of oppression, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, are those that so insinuate themselves into the fabric of our lives and our communication universe and into the recesses of our minds that we don't even realize they're acting upon us. Years ago, I heard, in fact, it was Stokely Carmichael in a talk, and he said, this is the most repressed country in the world, United States. Now, on the face of it, that seemed, you know, ridiculous. There are countries where they're rounding up people and death squatting and murdering and killing. But what he really meant, he just left out a word, it's a very good insight. He meant this is the most effectively repressive country. Look at around the whole world. On the Iraq War, people against the war, 65% here, 85% there, in Japan, 80%, in Spain, 92%, in Italy, 87%, in Lithuania, everybody around the world. In the U.S., 73% supported the president. Effectively, we really have a very tough struggle here. And these are the things, I'm bringing all these theoretical things up because in actual practice we're dealing with them all the time. So, only by setting the dissident viewpoint against the established one, do we have a better chance of moving toward a closer approximation of the truth. In other words, the dissenting view is not just another opinion among many. Its task is to contest the prevailing orthodoxy and broaden the boundaries of debate. And the function of conventional opinion is just the opposite, to keep the parameters of debate as narrow as possible. We may not, there's another point, we may not be capable of perfect objectivity, but we do know there's a reality out there. Years ago, Lillian Hellman, is that her name?
Yes.
I'm getting her mixed up. Lillian Hellman's the writer.
Yes, she's a playwright.
Who's the Lillian Hellman who's the actress in person? Lillian, what? Lily, thank you. Lily Tomlin. Boy, I wasn't even close, was I? Oh, man. All my friends, as they're getting older now, they're all worrying about, oh, my God, my mind is going. But I was this way when I was 18, so I'm not worried about it. Lily Tomlin. Lily Tomlin and the writer of the play was her partner, Joan Robinson, or Jane Robinson.
Jane.
Why that if I'm batting 1,000 the wrong way? Jane what? Jane Wagner?
Yes.
Okay. That's right. Joan Robinson's another writer. Okay. They did a play called, I probably got this wrong too, called Looking for Signs of Intelligence in the Universe.
The Search for Intelligent Life.
There it is. The Search for Intelligent Life. Hey, come on up here and take this. I'm glad you came. The Search for Intelligence Life in the Universe. There was a great line in it where one of her characters turns and says, "What's reality? Just a collective hunch." And in a way, that's kind of funny. But if reality exists, then so must truth. And we have a collective hunch that truth does exist because we know liars exist. We may not always know when we're being lied to, but after a while we catch on. You know that old saying, you can't fool all the people all the time, but if you do it once, it's good for 4 years. And what a 4 years it's been, huh? So common sense in everyday life oblige us to make judgments and act as if some images and information are closer to the truth than others. Misrepresentations can be exposed sometimes by a process of feedback, as when subsequent events fail to support the original image. Sometimes the orthodox view becomes, by the way, sometimes it can become so entrenched that evidence becomes irrelevant. I mean, you can present evidence and it will not dent. And I'm talking about progressive people that I've dealt with on the issue of Yugoslavia, for instance, where the demonization of the Serbian people and the democratically elected president, Slobodan Milosevic, to cite one of the great recent achievements of Western propaganda, it did take in many liberals and progressives. For instance, most think he committed genocide, and there's no evidence for it. The Hague kangaroo court that's trying him right now, financed by the U.S. and Great Britain, it's not the Hague, it's not the World Court, they just stuck it in the Hague very opportunistically to give you the impression that it has some of the aura of the World Court will rub off on it. They've just dropped the charge against Milosevic of genocide because the Serbs didn't commit genocide. There was no mass killing. There were massacres by all the different sides, Croatians, Muslims, Serbs, with the Serbs generally getting the worst of it, certainly in Croatia. Well, you just try to broach that subject. It's incredible. It's incredible how evidence really becomes irrelevant. But sometimes at least, there are limits as to how officialdom and the corporate-owned press can finesse reality. These are the limits of propaganda itself. Official propaganda gave us a quick and easy liberation of Iraq. But reality forces us to ask, why are we still there? And you see, and the propagandists can't deny that we're still there. Propaganda tells us that U.S. troops were gratefully received by the Iraqi people. But then why are these people screaming their hatred and engaging in a war of resistance at great cost to themselves? Propaganda tells us that a fanatical handful of terrorists and Ba'athist holdouts are causing most of the trouble. But how can... I was in a Q&A talk I gave recently, someone brought up Rumsfeld's comment that it's a handful of fanatics and foreign agitators who've slipped in and a few Ba'athist Saddam Hussein holdovers who were perpetrating all this. I said, how can a handful pin down two Marine divisions and the 82nd Airborne, 165,000 coalition troops, most of whom are scared out of their wits that they're going to get blown away in the next step? Well, consider Vietnam. For years, the press transmitted the official view of the war in Vietnam. It's a myth that the press gave the story to America and turned the people against the war. That's a myth. The U.S. Army itself did a study and found that that wasn't true, that the media were perfectly cooperative with the Vietnam War effort, and that what really turned people around was the reality of the war, the prolongation and the immense casualties and the immense destruction going on there when they got little glimpses of that. That's what turned them around. But that dominant paradigm, for those of us who struggled through those years and sacrificed our careers on Vietnam, that dominant paradigm prevailed. The debate on the war was limited to those between those who said we could win and those who said we could not. That was the whole debate. It was about the operational question. The implication being of that second side, that if we could win, well, then we wouldn't have any argument and we'd be supporting you too. Those of us who said we shouldn't be there no matter who wins or what the results, we had no right to intervene, that the intervention was not in the interest of the Indochinese people nor the U.S. people, we never got a platform in the mainstream media because we were deemed ideological and not objective, not fair and balanced. Sometimes the dominant paradigm can suppress and ignore an entire enormity. For instance, the bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. That went on a mass slaughter, a massive operation, which the White House and the press kept from the public and the Congress for quite some time. I mean, people knew here or there. But you see, the media, the mainstream media, do not only control opinion, they control opinion visibility. And that's important. There's no congressman's going to get up and start trying to agitate against an imaginary bombing in Cambodia if he's got no backup, if there's no information, there's no public hearing it. So that went for years, that bombing, without any kind of public acknowledgement. But total suppression is not always possible. Now, hear what I just said. Total suppression is possible, but it's not always possible. Not even in a totalitarian state. Hitler's minister of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, discovered that reality. He discovered the limits of propaganda when he kept trying to explain to the German people how invincible German armies were winning victory after victory while the victorious battles were being fought closer and closer to German territory. I knew a guy who was a school kid in Nazi Germany. And he's the one who told me that. He said, we knew something was very funny because on the maps, the pins on the maps where the teacher would say, and we won a battle here, and we won a battle there, and we destroyed them outside of, you know, of Bastogne, and we destroyed them. And the pins, every day the pins were getting, or every week, the pins were getting closer and closer to the German border until finally they were inside Germany, and the Germans kept winning all these victories, but saving themselves, kind of pulling back in the meantime. So there are limits. And so with Vietnam, that's what turned it. And that's why the policymakers say that the media did it. The press could not totally ignore the awful actuality of the war. It couldn't pretend the war didn't exist and was not taking lives. That was the reality which set the limits of propaganda. The problem is really compounded when we get away from basic, undeniable, concrete events and into the area of intent and motivation. Much of the debate right now with the present administration is about intent. Why? Why did you do this? What are you doing? And the reasons they give are not reasons that we believe. But we really can't. There's a very funny thing about intent. They say they are intervening to defend democracy, thwart aggression, fight terrorism, rescue a besieged nation, overthrow a corrupt and brutal tyrant, etc. These are the standard precepts of the dominant paradigm in regard to U.S. foreign policy. That's one of the hardest areas to break. Harder even than criticism of corporate America. Those would be the two. But this global domination to make the world safe for corporate America, that is something, it's very hard to get anything resembling a debate going on that. But how do we determine that their statements of what their intentions are false? I mean, no one's ever seen an intent or a motive. Intent and motive are not empirical. They're something that can only be ascribed, inferred, imputed, deduced. But some insertions of intent, that is, the things that relate to the intent, can be empirically tested. So when U.S. rulers say they're attacking Iraq because of its links to Al-Qaeda or its weapons of mass destruction, this is a statement of motive that rests on empirical evidence, or in this case, non-evidence. When U.S. rulers say they're bombing Yugoslavia to stop the Serbs from ethnically cleansing Kosovo, we can note that the mass exodus from Kosovo began after the bombing started, and that Albanian and Serbian refugees said they fled because of the bombing. And some of the Serbs said they fled because of the KLA terrorism. Or when U.S. rulers say they bombed Yugoslavia because of the genocidal slaughter of 100,000 Albanians, with hundreds of victims dumped into the Trepka mines, we can point out eventually that the aerial attacks began well before this information became public, so it can't be used as a reason for the bombing. We can point out that the 100,000 bodies, and by the way, the Wall Street Journal did point this out, the 100,000 bodies never materialized, never found, to this day have not found these massive graves, that not a single body or bone, belt buckle, or strand of hair was found in the Trepka mines. No bodies were dumped. There were not thousands of bodies dumped in the Trepka mines. There was nothing. It was a propaganda story. And that the several thousand bodies that were buried around in Kosovo, mass graves, and NATO defined mass grave as two or more people in the grave. There usually was no determination of cause of death and no determination of the nationality of the corpses. So you can refute those things, but you see, someone can still maintain, okay, all that's not true, but these are still my motives, and you can't prove. My motives are still to stop bad things from happening, working in a good way. In trying to establish what motivates U.S. foreign policy, we can't run laboratory tests with history, but we can observe repeatable patterns. We can observe that any leader or political movement or nation that attempts to depart from the free market global system, that pursues any kind of redistributive politics that benefits the general populace, that attempts to use its land, labor, capital, natural resources, and markets in self-developing, self-defining ways. Any leader, political movement, or nation that does that is subjected to demonization, denigrated as corrupt, oppressive, a threat to peace and stability, or just inexplicably anti-American and anti-West. Whatever the hell that means. They're anti-West. It's really a buzzword. It's a euphemism for anti-Western global finance capitalist investment. Once they're so demonized, then U.S. leaders claim license to undermine that country's government with sanctions, trade embargoes, economic sabotage, subversive destabilization, mercenary paramilitaries, or if all these things fail, then direct aerial attacks and invasion by U.S. forces. The U.S. has invaded just since the post-Cold War era. They've invaded Grenada, Panama, well, not post-Cold War, but close to that. Grenada, Panama, Somalia, Kosovo through NATO, and Yugoslavia, Iraq twice. They've sent troops into Central Asia and the like. There's no communist government. There's no rogue nation. There's no anti-West country that has a record of this kind of aggression that the U.S. has. Now, this formula of demonizing and then setting up your good intentions, proclaiming them, and then going in and whacking the country, destroying it, strangling it, squeezing it, overthrowing its leaders through surrogate forces in the country or whatever else, that has been going on for generations. Most recently, I can give you a list. Allende in Chile, Gaddafi in Libya, an attempt at him. They didn't overthrow him. The New Jewel Movement in Grenada, Noriega in Panama, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, Milosevic in Yugoslavia, the FARC guerrillas in Colombia, the Soviet-supported revolutionary government in Afghanistan, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Aristide in Haiti, and Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And that Saddam Hussein truly was an oppressor. But they always leave out the fact that he was CIA supported and his role was to destroy the Iraqi revolution. Needless to say, that's just the kind of analysis, this lining up I've just done, of the kinds of countries that the U.S. targets and attacks. That's just the kind of analysis the major news media do not do and which they would dismiss as ideological, paranoid, conspiracy, whatever. You could also look at the consistent pattern of U.S. global interventionism. Since World War II, the U.S. government has given over $240 billion, $240 billion in military aid to train and equip and subsidize about 2.5 million troops and internal security forces in more than 90 nations. Not to defend these nations from outside invasion. Very few of them ever were threatened by attack from neighboring countries, but to defend them against their own restive populations. Well, how do you demonstrate that? How do you know that? And again, you do this by correlation, by looking at the patterns of intervention. First, we observed that U.S.-supported military and security forces and death squads in these various countries were used repeatedly against certain populations to destroy popular reformist movements, popular insurgencies. They were used against liberal clergymen, against journalists, against student leaders, peasant leaders who were looking for land redistribution. They weren't used against capitalists and reactionaries and fascist generals or any of that sort of thing. They were working with the capitalist reactionaries and fascists. Second, U.S.-sponsored aid and forces have never been used to assist a popular reformist, or let alone revolutionary movement or government. Not in Guatemala, not in Nicaragua, not in Palestine or Lebanon, not in South Africa or South Korea, not anywhere, not in China, until China opened its economy to massive private investment, with millions of Chinese workers now working without contracts under terrible conditions, 12-hour days, 6-7-day weeks. Not until China privatized and dismantled much of its public health system and other human services. And U.S. rulers never assisted revolutionary Vietnam. They spent billions to destroy and kill 2 million to stop that revolution from happening. But I mean, after the Vietnam War, not until Vietnam began doing the same as China, with now more than 60% of its economy privately owned, corporate owned, and more than half of Vietnamese workers working without contracts under very terrible conditions. Not in socialist Libya, where Libya was shown nothing but hostility. Gaddafi was treated in no way but in a demonized manner until very recently, a month or two ago, when he promised to open the country to Western investment. I mean, do you really think they changed their policy because he said, we're not going to do any more chemical bacteriological research? And Tony Blair in the U.S. says, oh, okay, great. You're not going for weapons, man? Oh, then we're going to welcome back to the family of nations. Well, you remember all that hoopla just a few weeks ago? I said, yeah, right. You were so concerned about that. I mean, what about Israel, Pakistan, India, a whole bunch of other countries that have weapons of mass destruction? You haven't done a thing, and you show not the slightest concern. But Gaddafi did promise and has promised to open up the country and is even inviting Western investment in now. You do that, and things change. That's why they haven't changed for Cuba. Cuba still have Western investors in, but Cuba still gets the lion's share of the investment and uses that for public services, public sector. They are not lowering their labor standards. They're not allowing their workers to work 12 hours a day in the tourist hotels and the like. For additional consistent patterns which give you some idea of what's motivating the policy, and again, the media doesn't do this, we could look at the regimes that U.S. rulers have supported. The ones most likely to win favor are those that are integrated into the corporate dominant free market global system. The ones that leave their economies completely open to transnational, privatized, deregulated investment. That adopt a neoliberal mode of maldevelopment, starving out the public sector. Such governments are deemed by officialdom and by the media pundits as pro-West and friendly toward America. Prime examples would be Chile under Pinochet, the Philippines under Marcos, Zaire under Mobutu, Egypt under Sadat, Peru under Fujimori, South Africa under apartheid, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait under feudalism, Turkey, Pakistan, Nicaragua, and others under police state autocracies. So how can U.S. rulers and their media lapdogs claim to be propagating democracy with a record of support for regimes of that ilk? So this is how a paradigm or a theory or a set of hypotheses helps you define reality and to see it. You presented a set of causalities that are consistent with the data, the kind of countries that are attacked, the kind of movements that are attacked, the kind of political leaders that are attacked, the kind of populations that are attacked, and the kind of countries that are supported, and the kind of organizations in those countries, like the paramilitary, the police, the torturers, who are supported, trained, equipped, and financed. It's consistent each time with this whole question of who supports free market, global, international, transnational corporate capitalism, and who wants to maybe move out from under it or get a piece of the action for themselves. Earlier I said we can't test history as in a laboratory, but sometimes the forces of events sometimes the force of events does put intent and motive to the test. For instance, for decades we were told that the U.S. needed enormous military budgets and military bases all around the world to contain the Soviet communist menace that threatened to encircle and devour us. That was their profession of intent and motive. Some of us argued otherwise. We said that if the Soviet Union were to disappear tomorrow, not thinking that it would, it did, the United States would still pursue a policy of imperialist domination and would still have all these bases. Now, as I say, the trouble with history is you can't control for certain variables and test it and rewind. Like, you can't take the French Revolution and say, well, let's take Robespierre out and redo the whole French Revolution, see what would happen then, how it would turn out. We can't do laboratory testing. But, you know, you can build whole sciences just on observation, on consistent, systematic observation. Astronomy, for instance. More than 2,500 years ago, the science of astronomy was developed. All its basics. Please shut your cell phone.
Maybe everybody could take 1 minute to check their cell phone.
It's not yours? Oh, that's so tacky. All right. What was I talking about? I was talking about astronomy. How do we get onto astronomy?
But systematic observation.
Well, it's really fascinating. The ancients developed, I mean, this is a science whose basic precepts were developed 2,500 years ago. They were then buried for 1,000 years by the Roman Catholic Church and Christianity. You know, when you ever hear people saying, Galileo and Copernicus, when they emerged with their vision of the planets, the world would never be the same. Here was a break. I said, what are you talking about? The world had that whole vision 2,500 years ago. It was just suppressed by the church. It wasn't a new, although Galileo did give an empirical view with the telescope. But, I mean, those things were discovered by the ancients. That's why those stars are named Mars, Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, you know, not Mark, Matthew, Luke, Pope Leo. There goes Pope Leo. The Christians suppressed that as they suppressed just about every other science and learning for 1,000 years or more. So you could look. Okay, so here we're talking about back to the Soviet Union. We need all these bases, our leaders tell us. We need this global military apparatus because we're facing a global challenge of Soviet imperialism. Well, then history made its own laboratory test. It removed a crucial variable from the equation. The Soviet Union was undone, and what do we have? The U.S. military budget is bigger than ever and growing at a faster rate than ever. All the Cold War weapons programs were continued, all of them. some of the old ones are being revived, like Star Wars and stuff. Almost all the military bases abroad were kept open, and new ones have been established in Central Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East. 14 permanent U.S. military bases are being built in what country? Iraq. That's the country we just handed over sovereignty to. And the U.S. has been pursuing interventionist wars more violently and frequently than ever. So this is a way of testing. It's hot in here, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it you guys? Open. Oh, why don't you open? I only go this far. I respond best to a slow rhythmic clapping. Okay. Can you open that door too? Another way to get closer, I'm going to wrap it up right here. Another way to get closer to the truth is by using critical deductions, not inductions, not lining up these countries and making a generalizable thing, but deductions about the inner evidence and content and logic of the mainstream media messages themselves. The philosopher Morris Raphael Cohn said that thought is the morality of action, and logic is the morality of thought. And one component of logic is consistency. So without doing any empirical investigation, without looking at Haiti or Yugoslavia, this or that, or anything, or what they say, we can look at the internal evidence within the mainstream stories and reports. And we find that, like any liar, any dissembler, the press and officialdom and the officialdom that the press serves are filled with inconsistencies and contradictions. They blithely produce information and opinions that conflict with previously held ones without a word of explanation. And I know there are panels and events. I just saw that great slideshow, which I thought was pretty good anyway. They're demonstrating this in ways. We... We can note the absence of supporting evidence for insertion. We can note the failure to amplify and explain. We can ask, why are the assertions that appear again and again in the news not measured against observable actualities? We know why, because they fit so comfortably within the dominant paradigm. We can thereby become more aware, with this kind of critical deduction, of how the news media are inviting us to believe something without establishing any reason for the belief. Well, there remains one hopeful thought, and that is that human socialization in any society does not operate with perfect effect. If it were not so, if we were all perfectly, thoroughly, successfully indoctrinated into the dominant culture, then I wouldn't have been able to record these thoughts, and you wouldn't have even understood them. In the face of all monopolistic ideological manipulation, some people still develop a skepticism toward the official ideology. Reality, you know, reality is a problem for the ruling class, not for us. I had this happen all the time. If I say capital is heavily concentrated, there's a small configuration of interests that are enormously powerful in America. They control the land, the lobbies, the capital flow and finance and this and that. And somebody says, well, that's a radical view, isn't it? That's your ideology. I said, no, that's not my ideology. It's just a matter of public record. That's reality. Oh, that's radical. I said, well, I can't help it if reality is radical. I say, the number of poor people in this country is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. Poverty is spreading. Well, that's your radical view. No, that's not my radical view. That's reality, you see. They've gone out and they've killed and they've murdered and they've done this, and these death squads in Guatemala murdered over, upwards of 100,000 people. Oh, that's not my ideology that told me that. That's President Bill Clinton who went down there and said, oh, we're sorry. You're sorry? Excuse me. You destroy 600 Mayan villages, every man, woman, and child, and you come down here and say, we're sorry. Oh, well, he apologized. Oh, well. I mean, there's some things you should not be allowed to apologize for. You know? But that's reality. That's not a radical analysis. Reality is radical. Reality is a problem for the ruling class. It has to be constantly finessed and misrepresented. Reality shows that there's a limit to how many lies people will swallow about the reality they're experiencing. If the dominant political culture were a self-sustaining, all-permeating system successful in all socialization, there'd be nothing left for us to do but throw up our hands. But neither history or society worked that way. In fact, there's always an element of struggle and indeterminacy. Along with institutional stability, we have popular ferment and popular innovation. Along with elite manipulation, we have widespread skepticism. Along with ruling class coercion, we have mass resistance. What is said of the media is true of the law, the university, political parties, science, and the state itself, that all social institutions of a capitalist society have a dichotomous tension within them. They must sustain the few while appearing to serve the many. So they must lie and lie and lie and conjure false issues to distract or flatter or frighten the people, or in some other way spin to win over or immobilize the public, or sometimes, at better times, actually they're forced to make real concessions to democratic demands when people are mobilized, too mobilized, too resistant, and the cost of non-responsiveness might be too risky. They make certain concessions. They give a little to keep a lot. Years ago, the American philosopher William James observed how custom and culture can operate as a sedative, while novelty, including dissidence, is rejected as an irritant. So I'm returning to my original point of this talk. Yet I would argue that after a while, sedatives can become suffocating and irritants can enliven. People sometimes hunger for the discomforting perspective that gives them a more meaningful explanation. By becoming aware of this, we have a better chance of moving against the tide, a better chance of resisting a corporate-dominated, fundamentalist, reactionary culture that is devolving today. I won't say evolving. In class struggle, media and culture are a key battleground. The ideological gatekeepers of orthodoxy and reactionism, they know this, and so should we. And by your presence here at this conference, I think you do. Thank you very much. I guess we have time for Q&A, is that right?